You're with Mike Ryan on today's News Talk Radio. TNT. TNT.
Okay, in Canada, the place where the Mounties roam free and Trudeau roams free also, which is not so great because he truly is a WEF dictator in the waiting, if not already. Now, a constitutional rights group has blasted the federal government's plan to create a digital ID infrastructure as a threat to charter rights and a step towards implementing a communist China-style social credit system. In the report called Canada's Road to Beijing, the Justice Centre for Constitutional Freedoms, which is JCCF, outlines how China's mass surveillance system operates and in what ways a national digital ID system is a step towards authoritarianism. What Canadians need today is not more unmitigated government access to private information, but instead a renewed commitment to charter rights and freedoms. They say they are moving on the road to Beijing. They are actually getting closer to what they're doing in China. Things are moving fast, and Canadians should be very concerned that a free and democratic society is quickly headed towards a society where citizens can be cancelled by the government with the flick of a switch. And just looking back at Trudeau's last couple of years, isn't that what he's doing already? And in Australia, we have to also, and the US too and other Western countries, but in Australia, you have to wonder why they are marshalling all their forces with all the surveillance cameras around Australia and with the knowledge and know-how of secret organisations run by the government, how they can also connect your own surveillance cameras and maybe your own personal cameras to their vast network. Is it just to make sure that when we have another make-believe emergency, they can track those who aren't compliant? Is it getting to this stage?
You are being watched. The government spies on you every hour of every day. People like you, the government considered irrelevant. I know some very bad things are coming.
Too late.
This is our chance to control the truth, the concepts of right and wrong.
So there you are. You wonder what's going to happen in the very near future. And the very near future is actually here. It's happening now. So you have to just, I'm just thinking out aloud here. Why would ASIO and also ASIS, for example, be on the Gold Coast connecting all the surveillance cameras? Why would they, if they're doing it here, they're also doing it in other parts of Australia? Next question is, how many of you know that? I probably think about zilch, except those doing the connections, which maybe we know something that we shouldn't. Anyway, just a thought, just throwing that out to you. But why would they be wanting to connect this massive, great connection to all surveillance cameras, not only in the Gold Coast, but throughout Australia? Now, don't miss out on a thing. Be sure to download the TNT Radio app from either the Apple App Store or Google Play so you can easily listen live to us anywhere, anytime. It's available right now to download, and we're keeping you up to speed on TNT Radio.
Digging deeper into the news.
It's the topics that matter to me.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
British drug regulators have become the first in the world to authorise an updated COVID-19 mRNA injection, allegedly to protect against the Omicron variant. That's the Omicron variant. Doesn't work. Anyway, this is Moderna's new booster shot, which will be used in people over the age of 50. Brits, that's a British citizens, trusting their authorities, will roll up their sleeves for yet another jab. But many others won't. They are informed by the genuine experts. Norman Fenton is Professor of Risk Information Management at Queen Mary University of London and a Director of Agena, a company that specialises in risk management for critical systems. He is also a mathematician by training with a current focus on critical decision making. First of all, Professor, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Look, you've noted that logic and science have ceased to be a thing since COVID. How did we become so stupid?
I think that right from the start of, you know, this COVID crisis, as they call it, they've used flawed data, or they manipulated data to create a kind of like a flawed narrative, which has driven this insanity. And it's, you know, right from the start, this was, I guess, mainly done by the kind of like the PCR testing. So the idea that you have this, you're classified as having this virus if you test positive under a PCR test, irrespective if you've got symptoms or not. Now, at the beginning, it was okay in the sense because they were only really testing people who were already critically ill in hospitals, so it wasn't a problem. But as soon as they started to mass test asymptomatic people, then you had this situation where they were driving the case numbers up simply because they were just massively increasing testing. And so they were creating this, you know, this idea that even after that initial first wave, when a lot of people did die, mainly because of, you know, poor health management and sending sort of elderly people from hospital into sort of care homes where they did get infected. Yeah, you had this impression that things were like really, really bad. And yet it's all down to this, you know, this weird way of classifying COVID cases, which in turn, you had these bizarre definitions of COVID deaths and hospitalizations. So in the UK, and I think it's the same in Australia as well, and certainly it was even worse in the USA, how to define it. They were defining people, they were defining a COVID death as anybody who died within 28 days of a positive PCR test, irrespective of the reason, irrespective of the cause for dying. And with hospitalizations, it's even worse, actually, because with hospitalizations, if you were, irrespective of the reason for your admission to hospital, if you tested positive within 14 days of the hospitalization or any time after hospitalization, then again, you're classified as a COVID hospitalization. So it's easy to, this is where the kind of like the you know, the lack of logic and insanity surrounding the whole narrative is driven by these flawed definitions and the flawed use of the data.
It was almost like a advertising campaign for a Stephen King movie coming out. You know, show horrible pictures and people falling off, just dropping dead. But the imagery always stays with the public. And I'm wondering how much that was part of the process of the diminished IQ level of most of the population. Well, because, I mean, surely they, I mean, even with, like, I was talking about my brother before, talking about masks, and he's convinced that masks, you know, work. And I said, just do yourself a favour, take a vapor or smoke, whatever you do, and just, you know, blow out. And you watch where it comes out. He said, oh, but that's smoke. And I said, no, but you've got smaller particles with the virus. It's going to get there through this bit of paper or cloth, whatever it is, through it much, much easier. So therefore, it doesn't work. No, it works. You know, it's going to save my life. And you know, they're convinced that, you know, it's just insanity.
There was a massive propaganda campaign. I mean, and they actually called it, you know, Project Fear. I mean, there's minutes of the government SPI in the UK, of the government's SPI meeting with these, you know, the behavioural psychologists who were part of the government's so-called SAGE committee advising them. God. And they were openly saying that they had to create an enhanced sense of fear amongst the public because people weren't sufficiently, you know, worried about it. So they had to create this mass propaganda fear campaign. And unfortunately, it really worked. And it seems like, you know, that there was only, it certainly worked on at least, I would say, 60% of the population. People who previously I would have thought of as being completely rational human beings basically became completely irrational.
I was looking, I often look at, because I used to live in Hawaii, so sometimes I'll look at videos, inane videos, someone walking with a camera, but I think, I used to walk around there and do things. And it was amazing how many people I would see in, say, in Waikiki, around Waikiki Beach, And they're wearing masks. Now, if you've never been to Hawaii, it's a very, there's dots of islands. Yeah, lovely part of the world. Beautiful, you know, trade winds come in at about 4 o'clock and you got sunshine and all sorts of good things. And they're wearing masks. And I'm thinking, what the hell are you thinking? And it's the same in just about everywhere, and especially in the nice places where you're out in the sunlight, beautiful breeze and all that sort of stuff, they're wearing a mask and they're doing a lot more damage, aren't they, to the actual person wearing it.
They are. I mean, we looked at the so-called biggest mask study that supposedly, you know, definitively claimed, definitively established that, that masks were kind of effective. It was this massive study of villages in Bangladesh, and it was absolute garbage. We actually showed using our methods, which are these sort of so-called Bayesian probabilistic methods, which basically capture uncertainty and capture the kind of like the missing factors from these studies in a way which which isn't typically done. And we showed that there was no evidence, from using the data in the study, which claimed this sort of, 16% reduction in COVID cases. It just wasn't there. Just, when you looked at the data, taking full account of probabilistic uncertainty, there was absolutely no evidence that the masks were. But when, as you say, when you see these people walking around outdoors, in sort of beautiful weather wearing the mask, how much of that is also sort of virtue signaling, as well as, in addition to actually genuinely believing that they're somehow protecting themselves and others? It is that. I mean, again, I've only been out in the UK once since the start of this period, but certainly in the UK, there is a lot of it is just virtue signaling. People want to be seen to be doing the right things. They see it.
Have you received the daggers with the eyes? They just look at you like, what are you doing? And I get that in the elevator here, and it's like there's nowhere for me to move, but I always think that I'll get to my floor fairly quickly. But it's almost like a cult, isn't it? Almost like a religion, the religion of mask wearing.
Yeah, I mean, fortunately, in the UK, there's absolutely, apart from they've reintroduced it into the National Health Service, but other than that, there are no mask mandates anymore. Surprisingly, I mean, you still see plenty of people walking around with them. But I understand in Australia, you still got, you've still got a lot of people having to wear masks.
Well, that's right. We're very compliant. That's what I found. And also, I think that the IQ level has somewhat diminished. Maybe lockdowns has shrunk the brain. I'm not too sure about that part. Look, tell me about the statistical tricks used to exaggerate the scale and severity of COVID.
So the basic trick is the definitional one. What people don't understand is how likely it is that an asymptomatic person, a person without symptoms who tests positive, actually does not have the virus and will not go on to get the virus. There's a lot of misunderstandings about this because you're told, and it's probably correct, that there's only a very small probability that a person who doesn't have the virus will test positives. And so I think, well, okay, then if you do test positive, you've almost certainly got the virus. Well, no, it doesn't work like that. I won't go into the details of why, but it's sort of standard Bayesian probability, which actually shows you that it's all dependent on what the current infection rate of asymptomatics is in the population. And it turns out that we've got the real evidence to back this up. If you during periods of relatively low infection, if you are asymptomatic and you test positive, it's almost certain you don't have the virus. It's a false positive. So, as I said, when you are mass testing people who are asymptomatic, you're creating this enormous number of false positive cases, which in turn goes on to the number of false so-called hospitalizations, which are COVID, and deaths, which are COVID, which are simply not. And then you've got the actual real data to back this up. So, for example, it wasn't mine, but I've got hold of the results of a Freedom of Information request to the UK government, which was specifically asked about the number of officially classified COVID deaths in the UK in the first 2 years of the virus. So from February 2020 to the end of 2021, almost 2 years, which was when virtually all the deaths occurred. How many of those were actually people who didn't, who actually died only of COVID and didn't have other comorbidities? And at that time, there were 136,000 officially classified COVID deaths, but less than 5% of those were actually people who died, you know, with because of COVID rather than just with COVID, i.e. with a PCR classified test. And people don't understand the extent to which the figures are especially exaggerated for young people. Mm. So in the whole of the UK in that period, I mean, how many people do you think under the age of 20 without comorbidities died of COVID? What number would you think?
I don't know. Bigger number. I can't really. How many?
People have no idea. The number is three. It's three people. And that's
terrible. Sad for those people.
That's out of this. You know, so people here, was 136,000 people died, you know, and therefore it's, you know, you've got lots of young people. No, the risk to young people is without COVID. The risk to healthy young people is zero. There was certainly a higher risk from, you certainly got a higher risk from influenza. And as for, and then there's another, you know, other data where people have actually looked at, even at the hospital records, the ICU records of so-called children who died, you know, with COVID. Again, there are no healthy children in the UK have died purely because of COVID.
It's just
and the really bad tricks, the statistical tricks, are all played with respect to vaccine efficacy and safety, because there again it's all about the way you define a case and a death, depending on whether they're vaccinated or not vaccinated. So a person, if you're looking at vaccine efficacy, right, how effective are the vaccines at stopping infection? Of course, they don't count people who are vaccinated and get infected within 14 days of vaccination. Well, you know, people who, if you're doing that, you can actually do the efficacy of a placebo. And if you're using that definition, you'll inevitably find that placebo is highly effective at stopping the infection. If you're just simply ignoring all of the infections in the vaccinated shortly after vaccination. So you've got a statistical trick there, which massively boosts up efficacy. And if, with safety, it's the same thing, because if you're not, I mean, we know in the UK, they're not supposed to, they are supposed to count people who die within 7 days of a vaccination as vaccinated, but we know in practice it doesn't happen. So again, a lot of people, the people who are dying, whether by coincidence or not, or whether it's an adverse effect, doesn't really matter. But if you're looking at all-cause mortality, you want to compare people over a long period. What's the death? What's the mortality rate of people who have been vaccinated and who are unvaccinated? Well, if it turns out, as it is the case, that you're counting people who died shortly after vaccination as unvaccinated, then you get this massive bias in favor of vaccine safety. And the other trick, which we've uncovered, which is a really bad thing, in the UK, the official Office for National Statistics figures, they distort the vaccine efficacy and safety by simply underestimating the proportion of unvaccinated in the UK population. So they say 8%, whereas the true figure is 20%. But by making that change, again, if you're simply, when you then count the number of deaths in the vaccinated and the unvaccinated, if you're dividing the unvaccinated by a much smaller number, which is what they are, then the death rate of the unvaccinated appears to be much higher when it really isn't.
Yeah, it's, I mean, what we do is this. We'll go to a commercial break. I want to come back and just ask you something, and just to show how ridiculous this whole thing is and how they've pulled the wool over just about everybody's eyes. This is TNT Radio.
TNT Radio's Christina Borgeson.
So you wrote quite the report. Basically, it's about assessing the WHO's candidacy as an authoritative global public health organization. What I thought was quite brilliant is you started very simply. Here's their constitution. And here's how they say they're going to handle pandemics.
So what I did is I pulled out the evidence from a very long document that the WHO has published in 2019, and in which they say they don't really recommend lockdowns. They actually, the word lockdown didn't exist prior to the pandemic. Lockdowns is a term used in prisons, and it's used to stop riots in prisons. So you don't lock down healthy populations, okay? You quarantine sick people to prevent the spread of a specific disease, but you don't lock down populations. They did not recommend school closures, did not recommend testing and contact tracing for an infectious disease that spreads in the air, because there is no point in that. They did not recommend mask wearing.
Christina Borgeson on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
We're at a party. Three little kids were playing in the pool, all under five. Adults were busy talking, glanced over, noticed a little one underwater. I think she needs help. That's how easily something can happen. It only takes a few seconds. Don't worry, the party had a happy ending. But we need to remember, fence the pool, shut the gate. Teach your kids to swim, it's great. Supervise, watch your mate, and learn how to resuscitate. I'm Laurie Lawrence. Kids Alive, do the five.
One kind thing, like giving us the clothes you don't wear anymore,
gets me a wheelchair and my independence back.
One kind thing, like raising money with a bake sale,
gives us comfort, food, and a warm smile after floods destroyed our home.
One kind thing, like challenging yourself to a sponsored cycle,
helps me sleep soundly, knowing my children have clean drinking water.
Choose your one kind thing and help change someone's world. Search British Red Cross today.
Telling the truth is the only mandate we believe in. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
My guest is Professor Norman Fenton. Now, I'm just before we get into our final question, I want to just ask you about the BBC. If they had used early treatment, ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, quercetin, yep, other ones like that, antivirals, a bit of zinc, something else just to from the doctor, but just early treatment. Do you think we would have ever been at this stage? I can't even see that. I think what has happened, we got caught up in the inactivity promoted by the medical profession and government. Then you go blue in the face, take you to the hospital, and you fall off the perch because basically it's too late. I'm just wondering, these people who stopped any sort of early treatment, medical doctors and so forth, government, how accountable are they for the deaths of people that could have been prevented?
I think it's a real problem, and it wasn't. I mean, you know, with the and so it's not just the failure and the refusal to give the early treatment. There was also bad, you know, medical decisions about people, you know, putting the elderly on ventilators and stuff like that, which killed people, and the remdesivir, those things. So, but with the early treatments, it's not just the clinicians. I mean, again, you had these genuinely fraudulent studies, which were basically rubbishing things like hydroxychloroquine in particular. There was a famous Sergisvir study. I don't know if you heard about that, which got, I can't remember where it was published, but it was in The Lancet, and it turned, which was basically saying, you know, hydroxychloroquine, you know, was proved not to work. And it was turned out to be, you know, the study was a complete fraud, and yet the damage was done. You know, you had, I believe Fauci was quoting that study, you know, to basically, you know, stop the use of hydroxychloroquine in the US. And there's been a concerted campaign of, you know, kind of like clinical researchers and medical statisticians who seem to have this sort of vested interest in waiting for the vaccine, you know, who have continually tried to downplay the effectiveness of these alternative early treatments. So, yeah, a lot of culpability all around. So, yeah.
It's terrible. Now you've criticised. You've actually got into the BBC, England's favourite, and the documentary "Hello Unvaccinated." Could you just tell me? I mean, have the ABC taken this, you know, with a stiff upper lip, or have they got a bit miserable about the whole thing?
So it's the BBC. So a few reactions to this. So interesting enough, I think I was the first to raise issues about the documentary before it came on, because in the publicity material, they were pushing this 8% figure of unvaccinated, you know, own, you know, that, but they were actually saying, you know, this, they were making out, well, by making it that kind of like focusing on that underestimate of the true percentage, they're kind of like making out that the unvaccinated is some crazy fringe minority. Mm-hmm. And when I pointed out that actually the alternative government data from the United Kingdom Health Security Agency was saying there was over 20% of adults unvaccinated, not 8%. They did actually change the headline immediately after I actually made that point on their webpage. As soon as I put out a blog post, within 2 hours, I had changed the headline to take out the 8%. But nevertheless, the program had already been recorded, and this 8% was the figure that was dominant in the program itself. So, but it wasn't just, that wasn't the only kind of like misinformation that in the program. There were so many other problems in the program, which, you know, failure to declare conflicts of interest by the so-called experts they used on the program was unbelievable. These were, you know, you had a guy who was actually the head of the Pfizer Center for whatever, Bristol University, and they brought him on as an independent. So you had all those problems, and they were also underplaying the adverse effects and exaggerating the effectiveness and safety of the vaccine. They were doing all these things, and a lot of people, it wasn't just me, I made a formal complaint. Lots of people made formal complaints. I mean, I got the responses. You come back with standard responses, right? Saying, well, you know, we sort of stand by, and, you know, this was, and well, that we admit that they kind of like, that their things on the conflict of interest were saying, well, they're not exactly funded by Pfizer, things like that. Mm. Well, I mean, if a guy's head of a university research center, which is funded by Pfizer, then they might not be directly paid by Pfizer, but effectively, you know, it's Pfizer who are basically supporting all of their research work. So they try to weasel their way out of it. Mm. I've put in a subsequent, because you can only, there's a kind of like a formal complaints process. But they try and stop you from following up, but there is a follow-up procedure, and I'm still waiting for the results of that.
Good luck on that. Yep.
But I think a lot of people, I think they were quite taken back by the number of complaints about that program, and the number of, it's, you know, that there's been lots of kind of like media, you know, I think the hashtag unvaccinated was actually trending as a result of that program, and not in a good way for them. It was actually people complaining about that program.
Yeah. The BBC, the government's magnificent political arm or propaganda arm, just like all the other legacy media there. Professor Norman Fenton, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me on.
This is TNT Radio.
Matt Boyland here with a quick check of the day's headlines. Russia has hit back at claims it's jeopardising Europe's largest nuclear power plant after the European Union accused its forces of attacking the atomic facility. The CIA is being sued for violating the constitutional rights of more than 100 people who met with WikiLeaks co-founder Julian Assange at the Ecuadorian embassy in London. And China has announced it'll conduct another wave of military exercises around Taiwan after a second US military jet touched down on the island over the weekend.
For a complete list of shows and our schedule offered on TNT Radio, simply visit our website at tntradio.live. We serve up the latest live news and current affairs presented by a host of credible and expert commentators who can separate fact from fiction, truth from propaganda, keeping you in the loop on TNT Radio.
Today in Brisbane, for those that don't live here, there was a protest about the end of medical freedom in speech organised by Queensland's People's Protest and the Millions March against mandatory vaccines outside APRA. Now, one of those present was a Queensland GP facing suspension by Australia's Peak Medical Board after he interrupted a conference hosted by the Australian Medical Association last month. And I would think that he actually woke them up, because they're all probably having a sleep, as they do, just like when you go to see many doctors. You can hear the snoring in the background. Now, Dr. Bay leads the Queensland People's Protest. That's a group that promotes opposition to COVID-19 vaccine mandates. Dr. Bay has until August 16, which is not far away at all. In fact, that's today. So That's pretty good. Good research there. So anyway, he has till today, I would think about 5 o'clock to argue why his registration should not be suspended. First of all, Dr. Bay, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks for having me on the show.
Now, I got a few complaints in at your appearance at that at the AMA get together because you woke them up. They were asleep in the auditorium, and you probably woke them all up. So, congratulations on that part.
Yeah, not a problem at all, Mike. In fact, one of the doctors at the AMA conference on that day in Sydney was Dr. Anne Tonkin. She is the chair of the Medical Board of Australia, and she is the person today who, in my opinion, illegally called me before mm-hmm. their tribunal to try to deregister me as a GP registrar today.
Mm.
So it was a momentous day today. We had about 450 people protesting in support of medical freedom and my fight against the medical board to allow me to continue speaking the truth
mm-hmm.
about the therapeutics that are being pushed on people these days. And the conclusion of the APRA board meeting today was that a no result, inconclusive. I'm still a doctor. I'm happy to say that they have not deregistered me today. And
fantastic.
The reason for that is because, yeah, it's a great result. The reason is because the chair of the medical board, she refused to, A, allow me to come into the meeting in the first place. They shut down the offices nationwide and they boarded up the office in Brisbane where we were protesting. And then just to make sure that I wasn't allowed any aspect of justice at all, they then literally kicked me out of the Zoom meeting that she had invited me into instead of the physical meeting. She kicked me out of the meeting in front of 450 people. So I think it's very clear to say that there is no justice from APRA. And if they proceed to go down this illegal and moral pathway, the people of Australia will be very disappointed and very angry with the actions of this agency.
This was Dr. Anne Tonkin, is that right?
That is right, Mike.
Yeah, I think she was last seen in World Championship Wrestling. I mean, she has that sort of approach, a bedside manner that you wouldn't want to be involved with. I mean, where do you see this heading? Can you tell me the end of this journey? Do you think they'll just give up and go back to their drawing board, or do you think they're going to do what other bureaucrats do and stuff, and they put their head down and they take a few steroids and get, you know, really big and tough and make sure they can do what they set out to do in the first place? Where do you think it's going to go?
Well, the ball is in their court now, Mike. I'm not sure what they're going to do, but I believe they have painted themselves into a corner.
Mm-hmm.
They can neither deregister me or allow me to keep being a doctor in their eyes because there are great consequences for them either way. If they deregister me as a doctor for speaking the truth, for being a patient advocate, for standing up for medical freedom in Australia, they will have exposed themselves as the bullies and cowards that they are. Mm. And I can say that confidently because I submitted a 45-page document today, yesterday, to in advance of the meeting to detail the substantiation, the evidence of my claims, both scientifically and legally, as to why I was speaking out truthfully in defense of my patients and the adverse effects of the vaccine. Mm. So if they choose to deregister me, they will find themselves on the wrong side of history and the increasingly clear medical evidence. Mm. If they continue to allow me to be a doctor, then I will claim victory as an advocate for patient change, and that will allow more doctors to speak out about the vaccines, which will be a victory unto itself.
And they don't want this, do they? They don't want you to. They want you to just shut up, do as you're told.
They do,
but
that is a strange thing, Mike. That's exactly right. Like you, they should be happy that I'm out there advocating for patients. They should be happy that I'm actually following the medical code of conduct, which actually requires me, as a doctor, to stand up for patients and to do things in the best interest of the patients first, not them, not the government's position. It doesn't matter what the government's position is. I must just do what is best for my patients. So it's really interesting, in my opinion, that they're coming down so hard on me purely because I'm speaking up for my patients.
I don't know if you can answer this, so if you decline not to, I understand. We would never have been in this mess, would we, if we had early treatment?
Yeah, I think that's it was very strange that they cancelled the medication ivermectin when that was a medication freely available in Australia. It was licensed for use in Australia, and they really did not like doctors using this early treatment methodology. And what, you know, why is that? It certainly asks the question as to why they're doing that. It seemed to me that this entire episode since March of 2020 has been a marketing campaign for the Pfizer and Moderna corporations. And when things are not being done in the best interest of patients, it starts to ask questions about whose side the medical board, ATAGI, and the TGA is on.
I'd like to think that with a new government, new federal government, that things will open up. I have to, though, probably decline that thought. If you think about it, the states that were very severe, although when you looked at the federal government too, they were quite scurrilous too. But if you looked at Victoria and WA and, you know, Queensland and these states, any one that was thinking outside their box was admonished to the back blocks. So I was just thinking, will the federal government then make any difference being a new government, or do you think it'll still go along the same lines as all the other Labor states?
Well, I don't know what they will do, but it certainly is an opportunity, a fresh start for the current federal government to wipe the slate clean and restore freedom of speech to Australian doctors. It is a fact established by my persecution today by APRA in their committee meeting that doctors are not allowed to speak freely in Australia. Mm-hmm. I would encourage and hope that the current federal health minister, Mark Butler, MP, takes notice of the petition I have sent him yesterday with more than 12,000 signatures requesting that he rein in the overreach that the APRA and medical board is doing to doctors and allow doctors to be doctors and get out of the doctor's office and let us treat our patients in the best interests of them and them alone.
I'm just also thinking about the APRA itself and looking at the headlines at the moment, because we have Scott Morrison, who was also he was pulling the strings for a number of ministries such as Department of Health. And I always thought that Greg Hunt was the Minister for Health, but we have Scott Morrison in the background, the Assistant Minister, and the one that was conveying or overseeing the whole kit and caboodle. And then you join the other dot to Alan Morrison, who's the Chair of APRA. And you wonder, because we always used to hear that Morrison was not going to, you know, he was not interfering in this. He was going to let the states decide. Well, with what he was doing as the sneaky Department of Health Minister, and if you see his brother Alan Morrison, who was who is the chair of APRA, you wonder. I mean, because you mentioned Mark Butler, and you wonder who is actually the Minister for Health, and the links they all have to these bodies such as APRA, making life miserable for doctors or medical professionals doing their job. I'm trying to join the dots here, but if Scott Morrison had an excellent opportunity to say one thing and do another thing and make it absolutely miserable for doctors to perform the duties, for the Australian public to be told the truth, and the whole thing is starting to, in my viewpoint, it's starting to stink like high hell.
Yes, I'll just correct you there. I think the current chair of the agency management committee that runs APRA is Jill Callister, TSM, okay. Jill Callister.
Yep.
Morrison may have been in the past, I don't know about that, but currently it's Jill Callister. So, but you're right, there are many people who are connected in various ways to the suppression of freedom of speech for doctors in Australia, and that includes Professor Paul Kelly, the Chief Medical Officer of Australia, who I called out at that AMA meeting in Sydney as well, because he seems to be heavily involved with the international health regulations and the World Health Organization. And I wonder what orders he is getting from those organizations, and is he acting in the best interest of Australians? I'm not sure about that, because clearly they are not acting in the best interest of patients. Because they've demonstrated that today. They have not alleged that I have hurt any patients. They have not alleged that I've botched any surgeries. They have not alleged I've made any medication errors. All they are alleging is that I have exercised freedom of speech on social media and in public places, and for that they are coming down heavily against me.
You must, being a doctor, and you are doing a lot more than other doctors, you must be a little bit disillusioned, or are you disillusioned with your profession? Because there aren't many like yourself that are out there fighting for the rights of their patients. It's not about a doctor's living, it's about the patient's livelihood. Do you feel sometimes let down by your profession?
I do indeed. In fact, when I had a show cause meeting with the RACGP last week, they wanted to know my view on things, and I told them clearly that I was very disappointed in them as my union, as my representative body. Not only did they not help me to stand up for my patients, but they abandoned me as well. They threw me to the wolves as a registrar, as a doctor in training. They did not stick up for my right to medical freedom, to my right to bodily sovereignty, to informed consent as well. And it's really disappointing that the senior doctors that I used to look up to, who I learned from and studied under, they have let us down, yeah, because they know more than me, and they should know that when push comes to shove, they have to stand up for what's right and stand up for the truth, because at the heart of the doctor-patient relationship is trust, and at the heart of trust is truth. So if they are not standing up for the truth, then how can they expect any patients or junior doctors like me to trust them ever again?
Yep, it's by the way, I'm just reading some bits and pieces about you today in the last couple of minutes, and I'm absolutely amazed and very, very happy for you. Look, just hang in there. I want to ask you a couple more questions on censorship and the medical profession, all those, you know, those wonderful chewy bits that we can get our teeth into, and sort of work out why the government and why APRA and why their profession has decided to crunch doctors looking after their patients. This is TNT Radio.
The midterms and America votes on November 8th. With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
Tomorrow, I love you. Tomorrow, you're only a day away. Patriots everywhere are singing that song today, but particularly in the state of Wyoming, where tomorrow, Liz Cheney, never Trumper queen of J6 herself, is going to go down to ignominious defeat. At least my grammar school and high school classmate, John Katko, had the good sense not to run for re-election, but Liz is going to press on, hoping to get Democrats to vote for her and push her over the top. Liz, there aren't that many Democrats in Wyoming. You're going to be defeated, and I think by a lot more than the 30 points you're trailing in the polls. From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
Emergency, police, fire, ambulance.
Yeah, g'day, mate. Need an electrician.
Do you need police, fire, or ambulance?
No, I just need an electrician. I've got a couple old crappy power points I need to get changed over.
Look, I'm sorry, I can only connect to the police, fire, or ambulance.
I need to talk to an electrician.
This is for emergencies only.
This is an emergency. I'm moving into the house and I need to get an electrician to change these power points.
000's sole job is to connect you to your nearest emergency service. So please, stay relevant and save 000 for urgent assistance only.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
Several world leaders and notable multinational corporations now actively promote an energy transformation to so-called clean green hydrogen. Mainstream media will not expose the facts on the hydrogen fuel alternative. Hydrogen is an energy carrier, not an energy source. It requires enormous energy from another source to create it. And this storage of energy in hydrogen is very expensive. It can be compressed or stored chemically at a higher density, such as in metal hydrides. But this is all resource intensive. If you want higher energy bills, hydrogen will help. If you want higher costs of living, hydrogen will help. And burning hydrogen in air is not so environmentally friendly. It may produce emissions with up to 6 times higher levels of toxic nitrogen oxides compared with burning natural gas.
Telling the truth is the only mandate we believe in. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Okay, my guest is Dr. Bay. He just had a great win today, and had two wins actually. One for the Australian public when he woke them all up at the recent AMA get together, and today he's still operating as a doctor. Look, I'm just thinking about the censorship of doctors and health professionals. Is this still as much a problem as it was, you know, say 6 months ago, 12 months ago?
Yeah, it's more of a problem than it ever has been before. APRA has unfortunately escalated the stakes. They escalated the stakes to an unprecedented level yesterday when they made a complaint. They themselves made a complaint against me to the Queensland Office of the Health Ombudsman here in Brisbane for the crime of being seen with the Queensland People's Protest Group, the group that I lead, on a Saturday in front of their offices at 192 Ann Street 2 weeks ago. Mm. I kid you not, Mike, you heard that right. They have made, they themselves, the body supposed to be taking complaints from Australian citizens about medical practice, has made themselves a complaint against me to the Office of the Health Ombudsman. And yesterday, I'm pleased to say, the Office of the Health Ombudsman told them to go away, and they referred their complaint back to APRA themselves. So I'm now facing a complaint from APRA to APRA about protesting in front of APRA's offices on a Saturday. So if that doesn't show you the level of suppression and intimidation APRA is doing to doctors, then I'm not sure what does.
You must feel confident with that, though, that that it's all APRA, and they're all, yeah. So and you can see what they're trying to do, though. They're like these naughty little children that have been caught out stealing lollies, and they go back and do the same again. And I mean, you would think, though. I mean, I was looking at Alan Morrison; he was the head of APRA.
Okay.
I'm just looking at also his exit was about the same time Scott Morrison's exit. So anyway,
right.
But we can't go much more into that because I haven't got that many dollars to give to them if they wanted to massacre me. But there is a story there, and we will cover that without being frivolous about it. So the censorship then is still there. When do you think this censorship and this dictatorial attitude, this don't you speak unless you're spoken to, when do you think we'll get back to being as we should, or do you think it will never leave us?
It will stop once APRA is stopped. That is the fight that I'm leading now. We must stop APRA. They must resign or be dismantled or have the rules pertaining to their agency changed. I believe that they are acting well outside of the law, and my solicitor agrees. We have analysed their complaints against me, and there is no legally justifiable complaint against me. Indeed, the Australian Constitution itself protects my right to political speech, to free speech, and on that basis alone, APRA has no right to lodge complaints against me and to threaten my registration as a doctor purely for being involved in political protest. Imagine what other things they may do to doctors if they were threatening doctors for all types of freedom of speech issues. It's really quite strange that an agency tasked with keeping the public safe is now prosecuting me as a serious threat to the safety of Australia, not because of any medical errors I've done, but purely because of my political speech. So they need to be stopped, and I believe we will stop them one way or another, either through the courts, through public protest, or through the work of like Senator Rennick, Senator Roberts, who I believe will be holding an inquiry into APRA in the coming months.
And I think the sooner the better. But again, though, it's all very well having an inquiry. But if it remains just that, an inquiry, and the mainstream media or legacy media or people don't know about it, then the result of an inquiry becomes just basically a waffle fest. So they've got to get past that and try and alert the public of Australia what really is happening.
Yes.
Here's another thing. Are more doctors standing up for the rights to question issues of public health, or are they still petrified and terrified?
For the most part, doctors seem to still be afraid, and that is disappointing. But there are more and more doctors standing up and getting vocal. The Australian Medical Professional Society, they released a fantastic document, I believe it was on Sunday, from their president to all the medical boards, the colleges of specialists around Australia, to all the nursing boards and unions, clearly stating what I've just been stating for the last several months, that our concerns about the vaccines are valid, they are based in medical literature, and that they need to be taken seriously. So things are opening up, things are coming out in the open, and I congratulate AMPS on being so vocal and out there like me on this issue. And I think that more and more doctors will have the courage to tell the truth to their patients. We have to, otherwise the profession itself will collapse.
What's your views on kiddies from 6 months getting the jab?
I believe that for children, there must be a clear therapeutic benefit to that individual patient, to that child, for receiving a treatment, vaccine or otherwise. Because of the extremely negligible risk to children from having COVID-19, therefore, it is immoral and illegal, in my opinion, to give any COVID-19 vaccine to children, because there are risks to these vaccines. So if you have the potential for harm to a child for a therapeutic with no clinical benefit, because they're only said to, they're saying that you need to have these vaccines to children to protect grandma and granddad, that type of thing, that does not make any sense. And that is why it is the highest moral outrage that we would dare to inject a child with something that has the potential for harm or lethality for them. It's a disgrace.
It's terrible that they're willing, you know, and you know, I believe and not believe, I do know that the vaccines, inverted commas, are not safe and they're not effective. However, if you know, pigs could fly and stuff like that, and they were, and they knew they had these, there was these events or effects that could you know, end their life or make them a cripple, give them myocarditis or pericarditis, whatever. But where in Western civilization does it say that we can sacrifice our children to save the adults?
That's right, and that is an ethic that they are trying to confuse us with. They're trying this on, that for the greater good, we must commit a crime, we must commit a wrong to make a right. And I believe that wrongs do not make a right. You cannot harm a child for the benefit of society. That is immoral, that is illegal, that is wrong, that is evil. We must get back to doing good to get good outcomes. We do not get good outcomes by doing bad.
It's interesting, though, because you don't hear most 99.999% of the people talking about that. They, you know, it's get the jab, but it's a bit like saying if there was a food shortage and there was no food, that we should start eating people, and we're going to justify that because they're keeping the rest of us alive. It is barbaric, isn't it?
It's immoral. It is immoral. And that is what we are fighting here. We are fighting in a moral regime, in APRA, in the government's vaccine mandates. And that is why they don't like me so much, because I have moral fortitude, and that is why they are coming at me in every way possible, because essentially what the APRA position statement of March 2021 dictated to doctors and nurses around Australia was that you must lie to your patients. That's what effectively it is. And I don't lie. And that is why we are having this conflict, because they are trying to force me to lie. They want me to lie. I'm refusing to lie, and they are demanding that I lie, and they are threatening my registration unless I lie.
Yeah, they're going to get you.
That's what it's all coming down to.
They're out to get you, though. You're, I mean, you can't walk down most places, and they'll report you. He's walking funny. We'll report him to somebody, and then we'll go back after him. I mean, APRA itself, I mean, do you think Australia needs them?
No, we don't. We need less regulation. We need less government departments. We need less government in our lives, and we certainly do not need the agency, this practitioner regulation agency, getting in the way between the patient and the doctor. When a patient comes to see me in my offices, and yes, I'm still working, I'm claiming victory as a truthful doctor, still working in Australia as of this moment, When patients come and see me, they can trust that I am treating them as an individual and doing things in their best interests. APRA is not, for whatever reason, is not happy about that. They want to tell me what I should be doing with my patient, and that is not the law. I'm sorry, APRA, you are wrong. The law is actually that the Australian Code of Conduct for Doctors is that I must put my patient first. So I believe it's APRA who is on trial, not me.
Mm. I was just looking at Dr. Anne Tonkin. She, I mean, she's got the probably the bedside manner of Attila the Honey, but she's an academic. I'm just looking here, 20 years as a clinical academic at the, I think it's the Adelaide University or something, but or at Flinders University. But she's an academic. Why wouldn't they put on doctors that are doctors? That's a billion questions, which we'll have to talk about next time because it's time to go. If somebody wants to find out more about you or the Queensland People's Protest, how do they do that?
Yeah, please find us on Facebook or go to our website, www.QPP, Queensland People's Protest, QPP.life, L-I-F for freedom, E.
Any more protests quickly planned?
Absolutely. We're protesting every week until they end the state of emergency. Queensland, 1 p.m. at King George Square every Saturday. I'll see you there.
Yeah, and smile for the camera because I'm sure APRA have got plenty there. Those Polaroids are clicking away furiously. Fantastic chatting to you, Dr. Bay. Dr. William Bay here on TNT Radio.